are here tonight because Daniel Neary, who is a best-selling, award-winning author, is gracing us with his presence for our Geneva Lecture Series. Yeah. And he has also graced us with some weather he brought up from South Carolina. So enjoy it while he's here. So if you're not familiar, my name is Brett Erickson, and along with my beautiful wife, Leanne, direct Geneva. And our mission at Geneva is to make space for big questions on life and faith. And one of the ways that we do that is through our lecture series. So since 1971, thanks to the work of the Reverend Jason Chen, who is here with us tonight, speaking of being graced with the presence, Geneva has had the privilege of hosting numerous guests who have engaged both our hearts and our minds with their faith and how their faith informs the excellent work that they do. So these guests include Alvin Plantinga, Cornel West, Marilyn Robinson, Madeline Engel, N.T. Wright, Martin Scorsese, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Brian Stevenson, David Brooks, and now Daniel Neary. So if you would like to learn more about Geneva and the upcoming events that we have, you might have seen some here behind us, we encourage you to sign up for our newsletter. And so there are QR codes that will probably hover around after Daniel is done talking. It's on the website, my wife tells me. Thank you. So before we begin, I just want to thank our sponsors for making this evening possible. I want to thank John Landon and the Law Office of Frederickson and Byron, and also the University of Iowa's English Department for sponsoring this event tonight. And also, thank you to our generous, anonymous donors. You know who you are, even though nobody else here does, and we are incredibly grateful for your support. Following this event, there will be a Q&A. So we have a mic set up there in the back. We have it set in the back so you don't block the camera shot. Not that the back of your head is a beautiful thing, but we want to make sure we can see everything that's going on up here. If for some reason you cannot stand up, I have a wireless mic that I can bring to you, and I'm happy to do that. So you can just raise your hand, and we'll make that happen. So Daniel, wherever you're at. Oh, there you are. Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. We are, like I said, incredibly grateful that you have graced us here with your presence today. Daniel, in introducing you, I could probably follow the protocol of reading off a lengthy list of your accomplishments, something like maybe a National Book Award finalist, a Prince Award, a Christopher Award, a Middle East Book Award, a Walter Dean Myers Award, a Newbery, a top book of the year for, NPR, New York Times, Amazon, Booklist, Bookpage, Publishers Weekly, Wall Street Journal, Today.com. Are you cringing yet, Daniel? Maybe a little bit? Okay, good. And so forth and so on. But I won't do that because there's no need to, and you probably already know about those things. But instead, I'll share that I read your book, Everything Sad is Untrue, for the first time in 2023. And I found myself in awe of how you were able to hold the hygienic supremacy of the bidet with the beauty of a transcendent truth worth dying for. And my opinion is that perhaps not since the adventures of Huckleberry Finn have we seen, at least not too often, somebody write such a hilariously heartbreaking novel and yet have it be so encouraging and uplifting and life-giving. And to be able to do that is a gift. And Daniel, we are thankful that you have shared your gift with us. Your writing is a remedy that helps the reader behold what it means to be human. And as a result, at least I can attest to personally, to being able to see better than I did before I was your reader. So Daniel, thank you. Tonight, Daniel is giving a lecture titled, Death is the Alternative. And as a result, there's a good chance that he will not read from any of his books. In fact, earlier today at City High, when we were speaking to a group of sophomore students, Daniel said it's his least favorite thing to read from his books. So therefore, for all of our sakes, I will, okay? And then I'll get off the stage here. So, and everything sad isn't true. Daniel chronicles the story of his mother's exile from Iran with her children in tow because she went all in on what she believed to be true. And in it, Daniel writes, my mom was a Sayyid from the bloodline of the prophet, which you know about now. In Iran, if you convert from Islam to Christianity or Judaism, it's a capital crime. That means if they find you guilty in religious court, they kill you. But if you convert to something else, like Buddhism or something, then it's not so bad. Probably because Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are sister religions, and you always have the worst fights with your sister. Amen. And probably nothing happens if you're just a six-year-old, except if you say, I'm a Christian now in your school. Chances are the committee will hear about it and raid your house. Because if you're a Christian now, then so are your parents probably. And the committee does stuff way worse than killing you. When my sister walked out of her room and said she'd met Jesus, my mom knew all that. And here is the part that gets hard to believe. Seema, my mom, read about him and became a Christian too. Not just a regular one who keeps it in their pocket. She fell in love. She wanted everybody to have what she had, to be free, to realize that in other religions you have rules and codes and obligations to follow to earn good things. But all you had to do with Jesus was believe he was the one who died for you. And she believed. When I tell the story in Oklahoma, this is the part where the grown-ups always interrupt me. They say, okay, but why did she convert? Because up to that point, I've told them about the house with the birds in the walls, all the villages my grandfather owned, all the gold, my mom's own medical practice, all the amazing things she had that we don't have anymore because she became a Christian, all the money she gave up, so we're poor now. But I don't have an answer for them. How can you explain why you believe anything? So I just say what my mom says when people ask her. She looks them in the eye with the begging hope that they'll hear her, and she says, because it's true. Why else would she believe it? It's true, and it's more valuable than $7 million in gold coins and thousands of acres of Persian countryside and 10 years of education to get a medical degree and all your family and a home and all the best cream puffs of Julfa and maybe even your life. My mom wouldn't have made the trade otherwise. If you believe it's true that there is a God and he wants you to believe in him and he sent his son to die for you, then it has to take over your life. It has to be worth more than anything else because heaven's waiting on the other side. That, or Seema, is insane. There's no middle. You can't say it's a quirky thing she thinks sometimes because she went all the way with it. If it's not true, she made a giant mistake. But she doesn't think so. She had all the wealth, the love of all those people who helped in her clinic. They treated her like a queen. She was a Sayyid. She's poor now. People spit on her on buses. She's a refugee in places people hate refugees, with a husband who hits harder than a second-degree black belt because he's a third-degree black belt. And she'll tell you, it's worth it. Jesus is better. It's true. We can keep talking about it, keep grinding our teeth on why Seema converted, since it turned the fate of everybody in the story. It's why we're hiding in Oklahoma. We can wonder and question and disagree. You can be certain she's dead wrong. But you can't make Seema agree with you. It's true. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. The whole story hinges on it. Seema, who was such a fierce Muslim that she marched for the revolution, who studied the Quran the way very few people do even read the Bible, and knew in her heart that this was true. Ladies and gentlemen, let us welcome Daniel Neary.
Thank you. I'm glad I didn't have to do that. That was, I appreciate you taking the hit on that one. That's funny. I haven't heard that in 6 years. It's true. It remains true 6 years later. Hi everyone. Thank you for having me. Thank you for coming out here this Friday. I really appreciate it. It's still a wild, experience for me to stand up in front of any place where people have chosen to voluntarily come and offer their time and attention, and that is not lost on me. And so I wanted to come up with a speech that would be worth your time. And so the title of it is The Alternative is Death. That way I sort of also had hoped that if you heard of it beforehand, it might help with turnout, you know? So you might say to a friend, hey, you want to come to Daniel Neary's speech? The alternative is death. Pretty compelling, I thought. You know? That way, you know, I can prey on all those folks out there who are still scared of death for some reason. And if it works, this could be a real breakthrough for me in terms of sales and fear-based marketing, you know? In fact, I might even change the title of my next book. You know, I can rake in the big bucks. It's going to be called You're a Nerd If You Didn't, and Your Next Doctor's Appointment is going to Be Deeply Worrisome. A novel. Have you pre-ordered my new novel? You're a Nerd If You Didn't, and Your Next Doctor's Appointment, et cetera, a novel. I'm just kidding, of course. My next novel will not, it will have some other title, and my sales will likely reflect my cowardice and not yours. In any case, I was wondering, you know, what could I possibly speak to you about? You know, what could be useful to you, dear friends? That is my ultimate goal. And in my opinion, the highest achievement of literature, to be useful in this cast about life, to offer more than escapist distraction, to help the reader in whatever subtle fashion to achieve a virtuous life and a righteous death. This is the purpose of art. And the very simplest method of that help would come in the form of instruction. But I found that inspiration, insight, beauty, and laughter are far better tools. And finally, of course, the holding of the hand and guidance to the foot of the divine. This is the only help we truly need. That is the purpose of art. To make us humble, to make us just, to make us merciful. That's pretty straightforward, right? I think we've got it covered. We've got that covered. You know, what else should we discuss? We'll put that to bed. Real estate advice I could help you out with. If you'd like love advice, I have that. The answer is yes. The advice is yes. Keep going. I have all sorts of advice to try to be useful to you. But when I think about it, when I wave my hands vaguely as authors sometimes do and say, when I think about all that's going on in this world, you know, the endless horrible things that we all agree are horrible, but in different ways, those things, you know, the way that things are, one might say, alluding to politics, but not addressing politics. We're all vaguely dissatisfied, I'm sure. You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. The situation of us, life, earth, with all that's going on. Here's a phrase. Now more than ever, I thought there's nothing more useful than to talk about bravery. That's what I'd like to speak with you about today. Cowardice, bravery. Because there's never been a worse time to let fear get the better of us. There's never been a worse time to run away. I've been thinking a lot about this recently because I speak to college students about art. And when I was a college student, I came up at a time when it was particularly fraught to think of yourself as a Christian artist. You know, the notion was that in the 90s and the aughts that, you know, Christians had relegated themselves to gimmick. We were a knockoff of the mainstream culture. Any big brands, the Christians would immediately co-opt, right? Not Abercrombie and Fitch, no, a breadcrumb and fish. No fear became fear not. Tommy Hilfiger, Tommy Hellfighter. In the New York arts world, the brand was so bad among artists that we fell over ourselves to say, oh, no, 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 I'm not a Christian artist, I'm just an artist who happens to be Christian. I don't know, that never seems like the winning path, right? And yet if we, you know, we thought that if we could just hide for long enough, to win the industry's respect, then maybe they'd let us hang out at the important artist's table. And I bought it. I see that as cowardice now on my part. So I'd like to talk about how to be brave instead. I'd like for you to have different advice, young artists. And that's why bravery will be the topic. If you came tonight to hear me discuss my oeuvre of stories or to do a reading, to think about all the various novels I've written about talking animals and tales of immigrant woe or murders along the Silk Road, then please consider the bravery it takes to disappoint you so thoroughly. It's almost an object lesson in courage, I'd say. Maybe the wrong kind. Maybe the reckless kind that will result in 1-star reviews on Amazon. Went to hear him talk about refugees. Called me a nerd instead. 1-star. That would be recklessness rather than bravery, of course. And I would never, by the way, insult you like that. There will be plenty of Q&A time, and I'll speak about any topic you prefer. We can talk religion. We can talk personal workout plans, whatever you like. We can even take the time for each of you to go on your phones and click on 5 stars instead of 1 and say something like, he flew across the country to encourage me specifically, and I think he deserves to make a living at this, or something like that. We'll figure it out. We're going to do a little workshop. 5 stars. For now, bravery. True bravery, of course. And we're a clever group, so we know that to get anywhere, we've got to begin with definitions. Let's begin there. How shall we define bravery? Well, because there are plenty of times bravery is contrasted with being smart. A character might say, you're a coward. And the standard rejoinder of the ostensible coward is, no, I'm just being smart. To be brave, then, is situated alongside being reckless, having poor risk analysis. This is, of course, the coward's definition of bravery. But at times, it can also be the idiot's definition of bravery. Thucydides, in around 400 BC, wrote this about his fellow Greeks. He said, what used to be described as thoughtless acts of aggression was now regarded as the courage one would expect to find in a party member. To think of the future and wait was merely another way of saying one was a coward. Any idea of moderation was just an attempt to disguise one's unmanly character. Ability to understand a question from all sides meant that one was totally unfitted for action. Fanatical enthusiasm was the mark of a real man. You can see it's not simply the coward who would define bravery as naked aggression. The nakedly aggressive might also choose to call themselves brave. That won't be our definition tonight, as we're neither. But I imagine if that's all I was going to talk about, then I'd have to change the title of this talk. And you could have told your friends, want to come to Daniel's talk? It's nothing but naked aggression. Alas, we've all heard the better definition of bravery, haven't we? It's on wooden placards in every Hobby Lobby and TikTok videos from Navy SEALs. It's the commonly accepted idea that bravery doesn't mean a berserker's lack of fear. Rather, it's being afraid and going forward anyway. At this point, there are so many varieties of this definition, from Nelson Mandela to Omar Bradley of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the Princess Diaries. It's everywhere. It's almost a truism. Bravery is the inner strength to control your fear. Wonderful. In the practical sense, this is, of course, a much better definition and much better for my purpose of being useful to you, because it takes away from defining bravery as the absence of something, fear. After all, it would be pretty difficult for me to say, want to be brave? Just don't have fear. That's like saying, don't think about a sandwich. Well, you're likely thinking about a sandwich. We're all recalcitrant, imaginative little creatures, aren't we? And if I said, don't do something, you'd just go out and do it. Don't purchase the works of Daniel Neyeri for all your stocking stuffers this year. That'd only make your family and friends love you all the more. Don't do it. But now we've defined bravery as an internal locus of control. Be afraid. That's fine. Do whatever anyway. Good. I'm sure we could come up with a few exercises to gain more control of the mind, and we'd be better off for it, more brave. But I'm not sure that's the way to go here for several reasons. First, I think there's still some fuzziness around this definition. Let me explain. If bravery is moving forward despite the fear, then we still have a problem of Thucydides, which is that we're saying, like the Nike commercial, just do it. Don't think, do. But wait, First, let's try to explore what that internal mechanism is that lets us override the fear and do. And second, let's talk about when we should use it. And third, let's talk about the hardest part, how to use it, especially in those times when we don't have the time to turn it on. The what, the when, and the how are far more interesting to me. And for those of you waiting for this speech to hit its Presbyterian organizational structure, here we are. We're going to talk about the what, the when, and the how of bravery. The one, the two, the three. Jesus will be the third one, of course, the how, but no spoilers for now. Let's start with what. What is that internal fortitude that allows one to go forward despite fear? Is it the quiet resilience that Emily Dickinson was so good at writing about? Let's take a detour into Emily Dickinson for a moment. She wrote, "There is a strength in proving that it can be born, although it tear. What are the sinews of cordage for except to bear? The ship might be of satin had it not to fight. To walk on seas requires cedar feet." I could read that poem over and over again, and that last couplet is my favorite. The ship might be of satin had it not to fight. To walk on seas requires cedar feet. Isn't that a poem amazing? Where did Emily get such resolve? Where did she get the cedar feet of bravery? This is always a slippery question, and it reminds me of times when the definition is waved away in the experiential knowledge of you'll know it when you see it. Like, for instance, that quote by Madeleine Albright, "Being powerful is like being a lady. If you have to tell people you are, you aren't." You could easily substitute bravery in there, couldn't you? Being brave is simply the state of doing and not worrying about the other parts of seeming. All right, so we've made a bit of progress on the what of bravery. Just have the resolve to go about the business of life without letting fear rule. That's fine for now, but let's note one thing. We're starting to shift our definition of bravery from being a sentiment, a feeling, or an absence of bad feelings to being an action, bravery as a verb. And if it is a verb, then let's worry for a second about the when. When do we need to just do it? When is charging ahead bravery and not mania? When is speaking the truth in a world of lies the brave thing to do? And when would silence be the best course of action? It is undeniably brave to charge into battle. But which battles? I don't know. That's a tough one. Why did I even pick this topic? I'm not actually certain. I could tell you about some of my other books if you like. I just wrote one set in World War II about the Anglo-Soviet invasion of Iran. These two siblings who find themselves orphaned and must strike out into the mountains to find where the nomad tribes are to see if they can live with them. It's great. You should check it out. I have no idea why I decided to wade into such deep waters as this. I suppose, like you, I see the maelstrom of media content every time I look at the internet. I doom scroll through headline after headline of not just bad news, but catastrophic, horrifying, apocalyptic news. I am awash in disasters from every corner of the world. I am like some animal in a lab experiment, and they've discovered a button inside my brain labeled abject fear, and they're pressing it over and over again. The information age is the age of noise, the age of the demons roaring in our ears. And more than anything, I want to know how to parse the real dangers from the perceived ones and when to disregard one or both. I'm reminded of a study done in New Jersey on the effects of such fear. This was a psychological study that began by creating a map of how far children of different generations were allowed to roam from the house as they played. For instance, in my parents' generation, they were often told that they could go as far as the train tracks at the end of town. And in my generation, we were told to stay on one side of the creek in the woods behind the house. And in this generation, children are often told to stay within eyesight so a parent can keep an eye on them. On average, this meant that the children of this town in New Jersey had gone from having a 5-mile radius in which to roam in the 80s to a 50-yard radius now. And what was the reason for such a tight leash? Why did the parents who themselves could travel all around town, why did they fear for their children's safety? Well, their answer was fairly unanimous. Crime. They were safe when they were kids, but crime these days was out of hand. There was just one problem. Crime since the 1980s had gone down across every measurable category in this town. The children leashed to the front yard were objectively safer than their counterparts in the 80s who could travel freely. It was all a matter of fear. And where did this fear come from? The ubiquity of bad news? Sure, very likely. The modern parents had simply lost their ability to know when to exhibit a bit of bravery. Beneath the overwhelming feeling that things are worse now in terms of crime in this New Jersey town and elsewhere than they used to be, is the when of it also a matter of you'll know it when you see it? How do we know when? The answer is yes, sort of. Yes. You'll know when to be brave and declare your faith, and when to delete your strongly worded social media post and go back to bed, if and only if you spend your time looking for wisdom instead of bravery. Pardon me. It's wisdom, after all, that helps you see past the screeching eels of the internet. It's wisdom that humbles us so that a threat to our ego, to our status, is not conflated with the truest dangers to our person. It's wisdom that gives you the perspective to see just how short-lived we are, how the stakes are not your reputation or even your life, but your rightness with the God of the universe. Bravery, the action, when directed as it should be, is a subcategory of wisdom. In the trenches of life, when there seem to be bullets flying in from all over and we're panicked, it is wisdom that tells us which direction to run, that isn't away from our fears but toward our principles. That is how we know when a situation calls for bravery or caution. And when we are in need of such fortitude, how can we muster it? This is the third and last point. How can any of us be brave? I'll tell you this. This is the part of the talk that haunts me and the part I thought about first because of a particular video I saw. You might have seen similar ones or this exact one. It doesn't particularly matter. They fit a particular niche in the taxonomy of online humiliations called the bad dad video. The one I saw happened to be at a velodrome during a major bicycling competition. A bicyclist loses control and careens toward the audience, where a father seems to be pulling his preteen daughter in front of himself in what the internet calls a meat shield. The photo is a Renaissance painting of bodies in motion, faces contorted in fear, surprise, and in the case of the daughter, many layers of shock. But there is no painting I have yet seen that fills me with such bile, such visceral disgust as the face of that man, so callow, so craven as to protect himself and sacrifice his child. I'm telling you now, I would rather any humiliation than that one. This is what they mean when they say a coward dies a thousand deaths, just looking at it. It is the exact opposite of whatever we are calling bravery. And it is tempting to look in the face of such weakness and decry the entire masculine project altogether. Shut it down. Pack it in, gentlemen. Or to go the other way and demand anything, and I mean anything but that. There are videos like this of dads saving themselves from a water balloon rather than helping their child, or moms running away from fires with their hands on their heads while their spouses lag behind them. In the 2014 Swedish film called Force Majeure, director Ruben Östlund had a similar premise. It opens on a ski resort in the Alps, where a father and mother and two children are seated on a balcony eating lunch. Off in the distance, up the mountain, they see an avalanche, and at first it's fascinating. Dad takes a picture, but as the wave of snow and ice gets closer and bigger, the mother wonders if they should go inside. "It'll be fine," says Dad. The children are getting scared, however. It's getting closer. It's about to crash into them. Everyone screams. And in that moment, Mom dives on her two children, and Dad grabs his phone and runs away. But the avalanche doesn't hit. And a fine powder of snow wafts over them. False alarm. But now, Mom and the two children, still panting from fear, watch as Dad walks back to the table and resumes his lunch, acting as if nothing had happened. But something did happen. Some shameful reality of the man's truest priorities had been exposed. A mask has fallen from the face of the father, and behind it is an image of cowardice and selfishness. The challenge with a moment like this, of course, is the time frame. The sudden jump scare of a ball flying at your face, an avalanche, etc. We might look at the dad at the cycling competition and be maximally charitable and say, well, it was an automated response. We all have them. Survival instinct kicked in. If he'd only had a split second more to think about it, he would have said to himself, well, this is a fearful situation, sure, but let me remember that one thing Mandela said and go forward with the stout resolution of an Emily Dickinson and wisely choose to keep my daughter clear of this bicyclist flying toward us. Maybe he would. Maybe he would. Give him enough time to study the Romans and get in a few workouts, and maybe he chooses correctly. But here we are. It was a pop quiz, and he epically failed. What it means to us, however, is that our definition of bravery is missing some element to account for whatever it was that just happened so suddenly. What is bravery? The act of moving forward despite your fear? And when should you do this? Well, when such an act would fulfill the will of the Lord. And how will you know what that is, if not by wisdom? And yet, how do you avoid becoming the callow worm on an internet video using his daughter as a meat shield? How do you meet the sudden pop quizzes of life? Well, you revert to your training. Ask any firefighter. In crisis, you revert to your training, into or away from the fire. Your instincts take you in whatever direction you've pointed yourself, your habituated self. That is what we see in sudden moments, your innermost fascinations. In my life, unfortunately, I've seen many moments of such crises. In my book, Everything Sad is Untrue, I mention a few of them. My father, in a moment of crisis, as we were escaping the country, grabbed for his career and his personal comfort instead of for us. I've since experienced many more sudden crises. From attempted muggings to knife fights to motorcycle accidents to burning buildings. And every time, the people who act bravely are those who have habituated their minds towards something greater than themselves. But friends, to relieve yourself of the habit, no addiction of self-centeredness. I've only heard one great piece of advice. It was that no one ever stops a habit or addiction. There is no such thing as quitting anything. There is only falling in love with something else. There is only starting something better. 19th century Scottish minister Thomas Chalmers said it this way in his essay, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. The love of the world cannot be expunged by a mere demonstration of the world's worthlessness. But may it be supplanted by the love of that which is more worthy than itself? The heart cannot be prevailed upon to part with the world by a simple act of resignation. But may not the heart be prevailed upon to admit into its preference another who shall subordinate the world? I must leave you there because I can think of nothing and no one more worthy of your adoration than Jesus. To love him most is to understand that our Father in heaven, in a moment of cosmic crisis, grabbed for us. How could we be any kind of artist but the one that offers such good news to others with no shame, no gimmick, no fear? In his company, you will set your sights on things so completely beyond this world that our petty fears, our compulsions to preserve our feeble careers and meager reputations, even our basest instincts, will give way to such bravery in small and great moment of crisis that we hardly consider them challenges in the first place. Friends, I wish this for all of you. I can't tell you what it will look like in your life, only he can. But I can tell you it is the only way to truly live. It is the only way to truly live, and the alternative is death. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, yeah.
And
Daniel's a big fan of mixed martial arts. So
there you go.
Nothing's off the table here, right?
I can give love advice. I already said this. I can give you real estate advice. I have opinions about everything. Yeah. None of them are correct, I'm told. But I do have a lot of opinions.
I'm an extrovert. I'll give a
God
start.
Bless you.
No, this is about the book. My husband and I are about, I don't know, a little bit more than half of it. We got it out of the library, and I hope that you'll sign it. They said we could have you sign it for the library. That's here.
How do you know you'll like it? They could all die in the end.
So, but we just got to that good bit that Brett read. But the question I had is actually, I believe what you said was true. It's horrifying because I moved a lot. Nobody ever did that to me. But you may not be using the correct names of sort of the bullies in your childhood, especially in Oklahoma. And I guess I wonder if they're true people. Has anybody contacted you? Anybody made any response to you now that you've kind of named them? And you know, like, no, named what they did. It's true. It happens. It happens here.
So the question was, I've spoken to, so let me clarify a few things. One is, you know, in that moment in the story, right, you have a young man who's sort of showing up somewhere and sort of is aggressively different in kind of his dress, in his manner, in his speaking. And I think there does happen, this thing. And sometimes it's just an immune response of a community to have knuckleheads in it who will do kind of knuckleheaded things. Yes, I did cover their names because I actually have no desire to like shame anyone. But another reason is I know those people and have, by the time I got into high school, quite a lot of them were my friends. I like a lot of those people. And I think the reason I like them, the reason I became friends with them in general is that we both took a step toward each other. You know, over the course of the high school years, and this is something for what it's worth, you might say, why didn't you write it? You could have made them look better. And the answer is, I had to stop at some point. It was getting quite long. And the other is, I am working on, you know, more stories, and in them, you will see some of this transition. And that transition is fundamentally someone who, starts to understand some of the cultural, you know, mores of the moment, makes a few steps toward them. And they, to their endless credit, in my opinion, took a great many steps toward me. And as a result, the sort of the Jareds and the Jennifers who get named as a bit of a Greek chorus in this story became quite a lot of people who not only did I go to their weddings, but I keep up with on Facebook. And almost all of them read it and were delighted by it. And, you know, of course, some of them were like, hey, I didn't know that. And the answer is we already had that conversation. We had that conversation when we were 18, and sometimes when we were 20. And these are people who I think of as fundamentally, you know, lovely people. But no place has a monopoly on knuckleheads. And certainly Iran and Oklahoma are not those, and they have plenty each. So I got to write about some of those adventures. You know, things, I was lucky enough that I stayed in that place long enough. And I had some really good adults in my life on the teacher side and on the coach side, that really helped me sort of befriend these people. And so, my hope is you'll sort of, you know, not to spoil it or give, but in over the course of three books, you know, some of the books that I really love, I'll shut up about this topic. I'm sorry. But, are these sort of incredible works where over the course of who knows how many books, you know, people sometimes have difficulty naming the number of books for this, but they know the character and their life, because that's what stands out. So I'll give you examples. Anne of Green Gables, Anne Shirley. You might have trouble naming every book, but you know Anne and you've lived with Anne and she's a person. Laura Ingalls Wilder does this over the course of so many books. These are like some of the greatest achievements in literature, in my opinion. Robertson Davies did this on the, if you want some trilogies on the adult side. He was a Canadian writer. And I think of that as just such a high watermark. I would love nothing more than to like touch the kind of the Anne Shirley quality, and you get to see a great arc of change, especially in her. And so, yeah, so the answer, I suppose, to the question of in real world as an adult, Daniel, when the book of that moment got published, did they contact me? Yes, of course they read it. It was, I got a great, lovely response. But a lot of that, like, friendship and kinship was not made because of this book. It happened, in high school. And I'm really glad it did. I don't like the idea of having written as an act of, like, axe grinding. I find almost all of it, you know, or as an act of, like, revenge. Like, it's just, I think that's a low, ambition for a book. But gosh, is it funny? And then, heart wrenching at times. And then, of course, it gets worse and then it gets better.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
A couple of questions, if I can bundle them. Mm. What is your vision or prognosis for a better government in Iran? Whether it's a softened Islamic-based one or actually some form of democracy. And number two is it possible in a society where the majority are Islam to have a just government and freedom of religion? And third, how's your mother?
Thanks. I'll start at the last one. my mother is wonderful. As I said, it was sort of, it did get worse before it got better. However, by the time I got to high school and went to college, my sister had already gone off to college, and we were both in the East Coast. And so she moved to Pennsylvania, where she is now, and she has a really lovely life. Met a gentleman who is lovely and gentle and kind, and I am so glad she did, and is now retired happily. So that's great. Let me see if on the topic of the sort of the moment now in Iran, there's some really interesting lose-lose scenarios for expat writers, and I'll explain them, and then I will try to answer as well as I can. One of the reason it's a lose-lose is sort of, we don't live in a vacuum. And so to be on social media and to express a particular opinion, obviously the theocratic regime of Iran is who doesn't like me very much. And, our family. And so, I'm not going to, I wouldn't apologize for them in any way. However, to sort of be extremely vocal in any kind of antagonism toward them as someone who's safe here in the West, it can be perceived, and I think rightfully so, as an uncharitable thing to do. I'll give you one, because the internet is full of screeching everything, and one of the screeches you'll get is, you must be a plant of the intelligence community trying to foment further invasions of the West. And so you're sort of lending your voice to, the argument that, regime change should come from without. Not only is that sort of a dangerous thing to do, it's also the danger is offloaded onto the people who are there instead of you, who conveniently get to live in the West. That's a pretty, I'm not sure, it wouldn't be accurate in my case, but it wouldn't, someone could make that case on the internet and plenty of people could believe it. And I'm not sure I would want it to lend my voice to any moment that does nothing but heap danger onto people. If you want to heap it onto me, that'd be fine. And I'll speak for myself. So my position is always, I think the greatest thing that could happen is the people of Iran, are able to, live in under a government, sort of first run by and maximally prioritizing the people. And in order to have that, however, I hope they can have it in a, it's an impossible thing to have, in my opinion, in a bloodless way. But who gets the call for that blood and why and when is not, is someone who has to have standing, within the community. So that would be one. Two, is it possible broadly? Is it possible broadly in a majority Muslim country to have, justice for all? That has happened in the past, in the distant past, but and in various places, and it begins with an understanding of what a secular government's role would be within a country that has a strong religious culture as well. That isn't something that theologically Islam, of course, does not have a reformation in that sense in its history. And so, although, you know, one could begin to make the case that a sort of informal reformation could be underway. That said, you know, a lot of this I would be speaking out of my personal amateur readings of this, as opposed to any kind of expertise. And this one book I would really recommend rather than my words here would be a great book by the name of Scott Anderson. It just won the Kirkus Prize. It's called King of Kings, and it is the history from 1940s all the way to, to 81, so right after the revolution and right after the hostage crisis, and sort of describes how sort of the Shah and the Pahlavi reign, who were a mostly secularized Muslim government, were overthrown by the theocracy, and how not only that changed, but how Western powers kind of interacted with it. It reads like a thriller. I had a great time with it. I read it twice in the last couple months, and I find that history fascinating. That's probably my most thorough answer on that. But yeah.
Hello, Daniel. Thank you for coming to Iowa City. I have now read three of your books, the Everything Said is Untrue, Samir, the Seller of Dreams, and Teacher of Nomadland. And there's some themes that's kind of popped out. One of them being that I knew before I came to your talk, these kind of young characters in kind of formative years, and your ability to tell stories through that perspective of somebody who's kind of in that preteen, teen age frame. And then two, after your talk, I'm realizing in all three of these stories, you've got these characters facing moments where they're kind of tested to see where their bravery is going to come from and where they're going to stand for their values. And so I'm just curious, as a writer, what kind of draws you to want to write stories from through that lens of a 10, 12, 14-year-old, and what opportunity does that allow you to explore some of these themes that you're clearly passionate about and trying to be useful to the audience? And as a follow-up to that, have young readers reached out to you and shared how these perspectives have resonated with them and their own kind of formation of their character?
Yes, at this moment, I'm sort of lucky enough that I get I get a lot of letters, which is nice. And I have to try to figure out how to manage. You know, famously, Mr. Rogers, the great one, wrote back to every young person, and I used to think that this was a something that I could do. It turns out he's great for a reason. I have not been able to manage it. I sometimes write back to some classes will write, and I will write back to the class, and sometimes honestly it piles up, but it's lovely that it does happen, and that's and sometimes they'll sort of ask questions as a class I'll sit in. I try to do that. In terms of why I would write for young people, is that maybe the broader version of that question? Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, Gary Schmidt describes the coming of age as the moment a child turns their face to adulthood. And that's not the same thing as the moment a child turns into an adult or the moment of puberty. It is the moment that they get a glimpse. And there are many moments, but there are a moment where they look and suddenly get a glimpse of what adulthood will look like. And that might be I'm going to carry that weight, or, that's a responsibility I'm going to have, but I don't have it yet, right? It is these moments of, and we've all had them, right, where we glimpse into, and sometimes they're tragic. Sometimes they are dreadful. We don't want them to come because childhood is sometimes delightfully, you know, carefree. And sometimes it's quite the opposite. And so I think of that moment, the coming of age moment, all the time. I think it's extremely fascinating. I think it's it is something that forms our sort of moral framework. I think if you were to ask anyone, tell me a book that changed your life, like quite literally changed your life, you would most likely, be told a book they read sometime between the ages of 12 and 20. Like, that's the window wherein not only are they thinking about those big adult questions, but they're quite open to having the conversation. They're not as certain about their answers. And I think of that as a really sacred trust. I think of that as a really, not only the kind of the most important moment in anyone's reading life, but also, you know, I have a friend who says these are other people's kids and nobody has a sense of humor about their kids. And that's true. I don't, and I will never have a sense of humor about. So that sort of, to be able to have that conversation, to be able to have it, carefully, but to be able to stay with a reader that long, that might be useful. You know, someday these things will be useful. We are looking for little heuristics on how to do this because we get these glimpses into adulthood. We're like, it looks complicated, right? Anything that has a sufficient amount of information and data, which adulthood does, all of a sudden starts to look chaotic and dangerous. And what do we do as humans? We build little heuristics, little rules of thumb. That's how we parse information. That's what we're doing, right? We're saying to ourselves, how do I read situations? What makes a person trustworthy? If I walk into a 7-Eleven and spot somebody, what are the heuristics I have for like, am I in danger or aren't I? If I really want to give my heart to, you know, someone else, like, what are the heuristics for the speed with which to do it? And the person who's going to be most careful with this thing that I give them, like, how do we have these heuristics really? And the answer is we get them through stories. That's how we get them. That's why the Bible is full of stories. But that's also why good stories will sort of help us build shorthand, right? So, and we use it as adults all the time too, right? Be careful, he's a Don Juan. What are we doing? We're using that character as a shorthand for a man who is a libertine and a player, so to speak, in modern, right? And be careful with him. He's a Don Juan. Be careful with her. She's all about Eve. The young ones might not know this one. It's a great film all about this young woman who befriends an older actress because mostly she just wants to take what she's got. It's this sort of conniving friendship. She's all about Eve, right? He's a Don Quixote type, right? These are all ways in which we use characters that we all absolutely know as shorthand for how to parse a complicated and difficult adult experience, especially early on. And I think for a book to be able to give you that toolkit, for a book to be able to say, okay, I'm scared right now. What do I do? The great, I'll say it every time, the great Mr. Rogers, right, used to say, if it is mentionable, it's manageable. Young people's literature's job is to make mention of things that then other young readers will be able to manage. I think that's really, that I can't think of a better thing to do. Someday maybe I'll like write a kaleidoscopic novel and try to impress the adults. But for now, I think to be useful seems like the highest calling.
Hi, Daniel. Thank you for being here. And my family's sitting there. We all read your book together. Everything Sad is Untrue. We loved it all. We loved the title.
Thank you.
We felt like we knew you. We loved you. At least your 12-year-old you.
No, sorry to disappoint. No.
But, you know, we laughed through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I'm actually reading a book right now where these 13th century monks are debating whether or not laughter is from the devil. And I just
is it Name of the Rose?
Yeah, exactly.
So good. So Umberto good. Eco, one of the greats. Yes. Not the great one, that's Mr. Rogers.
But I was wondering if you could speak on the role of laughter in your conversion story, your faith journey. And even if I could be like everyone else and ask two questions, I heard too from a number of sources that Iran is experiencing a huge boom in conversions.
Yes.
Is that true?
It sure is, and I'm very happy about that.
Okay.
It is a place, it's like one of those per capita stats where it's like by speed, it's going, it's not like taking over the country or anything like that. It's not, numerically some juggernaut just yet, but, Iran is absolutely experiencing, an incredible awakening of, Christian conversion. And I think that's an incredible, feature, And if I wouldn't get into trouble on Twitter, I'd be like, yeah, that rules. But the answer to your question was laughter. Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example right there, right? Like, we're literally talking about a government that, like, sends killers, and I think laughing at them is pretty funny and a pretty good move. I think Umberto Eco's book, The Name of the Rose, is a fantastic novel as well. But I would not fall, I would fall on the side of pro-laughter for several reasons. One is, well, from a writing perspective, it's fundamentally like one of the most important tools and one of the reasons for that. And screenwriters will tell you this all the time. They'll tell you, you know, in a good screenplay, make them laugh, make them cry, then get out of there before they get bored of you. And the answer is like, yeah, that's exactly it. And in that order. Because it is, boy, you can make them cry and then make them laugh, but that's way, way harder. And I'll tell you why, because crying is a much more vulnerable thing to do. And the only reason someone would let you do it. I mean, we've all read novels that are like trying to make you cry. And you can feel them like cajoling you and you're repulsed by it. You're bothered. You're manipulated. You feel angered that this person is trying to grab the wheel and take you over here. And you say, I'm not going to go there. Right. But when we laugh, we're doing the same thing, right? You're giving me control. You're letting me make you laugh. But it's a gentle one because you like it. It's pleasant. But you've fundamentally also still given me the control. And it's so much easier to make an audience cry after you've made them laugh than it is the opposite way or just without it. So fundamentally, it's a form of intimacy. It's a form of sharing. I can't break bread with everybody who reads my books, but I can laugh with them first and then we can cry. Right. And so, so I think it's a natural step of the, like, a natural step of the increase of intimacy between the reader and the writer, which I think is effective. But then the question is, why laugh? Like, is laughter broadly, what benefit does it have? Well, I mean, I'm a Christian who believes in the Bible, and in quite often, it mentions the joy of the Lord. It is not, you know, it quite often, and it is not only our strength, but we are, you know, he sings over us. He is a creator who is not simply monotone and grave, although he is those things. He is also the law, and he is deadly serious, and at times he is angry. And we should be very, very, very careful of that as well. We should be very respectful of that and fearful. But he's also very joyous and delighted by us. And when he sees what he's made, he says it's good. These are all functions of a creator who giggles, and I think it's wonderful. And so to remove that half is a complete silliness to me. I also think laughter is by far the best use of pain. You know, there are so many great examples. You know, you go to the common cliched examples, right? Of like, when was the first comedy written about World War II? And the answer is during World War II by inmates of a camp. Like, quite literally, the work and design of laughter is to be helpful to us. And so, it seems like I'm saying good is good. Which is pretty simple, but I think often people will sort of sometimes conflate laughter with derision, laughter with like punchlines, laughter with mocking, right? And that's often also accused of laughter, but that's only one category of laughter, right? I think laughter as spontaneous overflow of joy is the best feeling we can have. So, I'm not even sure. I'm trying really hard to like give the opponent a decent argument. Like, move on. You know, yes. Yeah. I suppose if you're laughing in the face of someone in pain, don't do that. That's in bad taste. but otherwise, yeah, pro laughter. Let's go with it. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. So they're kind of
Arlen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, good memory.
Yeah.
You didn't call me Arlene. Arlene. I would say there are maybe two aspects to bravery. There is like anticipating something difficult that's going to happen, and then enduring something difficult once it happens, and being brave in the midst of that. And I would say throughout church history, persecution may be one of the biggest forms of Christian bravery that we have to endure. And it sounds like your life has been full of quite a lot of that, having like fleeing from an oppressive government and then maybe like 0.5 notches down in the persecution scale, you're in the writing world. So that would probably, you know, you probably have a lot of experience with this. What is your advice for, you know, Christians in the modern day enduring persecution for being a, you know, bearer of the cross? And yeah, how would you advise us in that way?
Well, I mean, thank you. I'm, as a contrarian by heart, I'm like, but it wasn't that bad, right? I mean, it was pretty good. I'm having a great run of it, and I'm very lucky. So I would never want somebody to go away with that, the impression that I'm sort of weaving some tale of woe. But I hear your point, and I think the harder question that I'm vamping in order to avoid install is, how would one manage, a broadly speaking hostile environment, toward their faith in the arts? Was that it? Let me try to reword it with other synonyms so as to give myself time. You know, what's funny is I'll give you sort of my anecdotal example, which may be broadly extrapolated from and made useful for you, because the principles of it are fairly hard for me to pin at the moment. Like, what is the best strategy, broadly speaking? I was given, when I went to New York as, you know, sort of a little mentee, an eager child, I wanted to be good. Why else would you go to New York? It's like sticking your hand in a meat grinder. Like, the reason I'm there is because that is where the greats were. That is where, like, publishing, you know, resides. And I want nothing more than to be good at this. And so I was like, okay, I'm here. Like, explain it to me, you know? And I sat at the foot of a lot of artists who, you know, had, you know, were people of various faiths and different backgrounds and things like that. And a lot of the advice I got was, you know, this idea that to be someone of faith, and this all broadly was a broad thought too, although especially for Christianity, because that's the, you know, mainstream majority faith of the country, was you'll be perceived as less intelligent, right? Less cerebral, less capable. You can either be artistically sophisticated, or you can be of faith, but you can't be both, right? That was like perceived as a you know, fatal flaw of your cognition. And so I'm sorry to say that branding really worked for a while. You know, and it still kind of has, right? In the arts. I mean, I think to be sincere in a belief, you know, Lewis talks about the idea of somewhat being flippant, and he speaks about it with some great disdain, but the idea of, to the flippant person, the joke has already been made. It doesn't even need to be made now. And as a result, it comes with an assumption of not just correctness, but, you know, smug mockery of anyone who wishes rather to be, instead of flippant, sincere. He has a pretty, you know, broad brush there, but it's pretty accurate. Even, you know, what, most of a century later, in the arts, it's, you know, this sort of aloof cynicism still has a better brand as the, you know, to be. I think one that's going away. One of the reasons is there's nothing worse for the brand of aloof cynicism than being around those people. And social media has helped us kind of burst that bubble. It isn't the most intelligent approach to for artists. And boy, have artists embarrass themselves on the internet by simply responding to everything that way. It starts to look like a particularly one-dimensional mental model, first of all. So one, being around it has sort of diminished that brand. Two, I think, you know, artists of, let's just say, sincere faith, have done a much better job than in the 90s trying to retreat from culture and build a subculture of knockoffs. Like, that really, that was a particular bent of the 90s and the early aughts that I think has safely, you know, gone away in a lot of ways. Like, we're not sort of we don't have that inferiority complex of, gosh, if I wrote Jesus in the Coca-Cola font, maybe it would be a little bit more winsome. Like, it's just such a silly and empty gesture, and it didn't work as well as it should have. And so, so I think you're watching. And then lastly, you know, the brush that we used to sort of paint, you know, artists of faith with was that be careful. If you believe something sincerely, it might leak into your work and you might try to convince someone of something. And as a result, it'll be propaganda. It'll be kitsch. And we've watched over the course of the last 30 years as everybody has become a expert at making kitsch and not much else. And so suddenly, you know, I think social media, but also in general, I think we've all kind of caught up to what Orwell's essay once said, all art is propaganda, right? And what he was effectively saying was above a quite superficial level of reading, all art tries to convince one of something. And you're like, okay, well, yeah, if we define propaganda as trying to convince someone of something, then we can say all art tries to convince you of something. And that's true. And we've gotten much worse at trying to convince each other of things. And so art, as a result, has suffered. And so I think there has just been this gigantic 30-year seeding of the ground of what we might call fertile, deep, resonant, impassioned work. And I don't see why people of faith couldn't fill that just as well as anyone else. And so the proof will sort of be in the pudding. I think that the context in which someone's making art nowadays is vastly different than 30 years from now. And I'm really glad of that. I'm very bullish, for those things. I think people have sort of had a little bit of enough with skepticism and cynicism and are like, okay, but what? And I think there's a lot of answers out there, but I think this is the good one. And so I'm very bullish about where sort of Christian art will go. That was like a series of answers, but I'll pause there. I actually didn't answer your question. You know why? Because I was setting up the context of all these brands going up and down. And for me, the anecdotal version of this was I spent those early years really in what I believe was I had this deep desire, and it was an overwrought desire to be a writer. Like, it was very clearly disordered love, and I should have subordinated it to my other priorities, but I didn't. I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be published. And so the first few works I did were, I know the market, I know I'm smart enough to do it, and I will do it in order to get published. And I'm telling you, they were published, and I got book deals. They paid for my wedding. It was success. And I'm telling you, I've never been more miserable than when books I was not only not proud of, but books that felt in no way relevant to what I believe became a success. And suddenly I was like, well, this was a nightmare. I would wish on no one the success of bad work. And so that was an incredible, for me, moment of, and an indictment of not only my behavior, but of my idol, which was to have been a writer and to have published. And when it won, it was empty and meaningless. And I said, so this was 10 years in. This took me a while. I like to pretend it was like a picnic at which I learned all these things. But then 10 years in, I said, well, you know, what if I wasn't you have to at some moment subordinate this to that being my faith in Christ. So, and then I did, and I started to, one, the writing became better. Two, it became truer. Three, it became more resonant with people who actually cared. And four, I was happy to see it succeed. Every time someone walks up to me and they say, hey, I read Everything Said Is Not True, I'm so thankful. One, it's like, I really want to keep writing. And that's like, you know, but two, I'm really glad. I really hope that it was useful to them. And I absolutely did not feel that way about the first three books I published. And not only that, I felt there was a sadness in, oh, we can never really be friends, can we? Because, you've walked up, you've said something deeply kind to me. Oh, I love this book. And secretly, I hate it. So how can we ever really meet? Whereas with everything's out, with all the novels that are in, those books have gone out of print, safely dead. One can, Chinua Achebe once said, one can never say it will be safely dead. And so, unfortunately, maybe they won't. But nonetheless, not here. they're not here to haunt me. Anytime those, you know, the books that after that sort of, and it was a hard lesson. They've met me, and I even if they're the silly books, the young reader stuff, they've absolutely met me. And that I think is, it's not about me, but it is, one aspect of why I'm, so pleased when I can speak to readers now. That was very different. All right. I'm sorry. You were so patient. Thank you for waiting. She's like, sometimes I love it that, you know, sometimes you get two questions, but then you get six answers. You're like, y'all didn't realize there's an exponential problem in my head where I just go, now what if this question was asked with a different context?
I love your topic, bravery and looking at fear and looking at how fear drives us. You talked about doom scrolling and kind of the moment we're in and the water we're swimming in the U.S. culturally and politically today. And I keep looking around and wanting a remedy, wanting things to get better, wanting us to be at peace with each other, want all the good things. So, you know, our pastor preaches about love your enemy. And in the course of thinking about some of these things, something dawned on me. People sometimes talk about anger as the opposite of love. Anger at your enemy is the opposite of love. And I don't believe that. I'm a mental health therapist, and when clients bring anger into the office, I'm like, good, tell me about your anger. You know, because anger is, I think, the strength to stand up for what's good and fight what's bad. And we see that in scripture. We see that God gets mad about stuff. Mm-hmm. We never see God get afraid. And I started to realize, okay, it's fear that's the opposite of love. It's fear that's driving this polarization. It's fear that's driving our hatred. And of course, the scripture tells us this too, that perfect love casts out, not anger, perfect love casts out fear. So I see the fear, and I see it driving brothers and sisters in Christ who I have respected for many years to make decisions that I don't respect. And I look at them and I just want to shake them. I say, those are not your values. Why are you acting that way? Why are you endorsing XYZ? Why are you taking that path? And one guy said recently to me, well, there gets to a place where you have no choice. And I think what he means is, I'm so scared by what I see from the other side that I don't care what values I have to throw away in order to save myself. You know, the meat shield? I didn't know that term.
It's a pretty silly term, but yes.
Like, I don't care who has to suffer for me to feel safe.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
So I'm sitting here wondering, as brothers and sisters in Christ, how do we help each other to have courage? How do we help each other to say, this might hurt, but I can't sell out? How do we strengthen each other? How do we not go there? How do we not be willing to look each other in the eye and say, I have no choice? I feel let down and discouraged when I see that among the people of God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's several questions there, and I think one of the, and I don't disagree with most of your the assessment, right? The assessment is pretty much looking as you said, and I do agree also with the idea that, you know, I love that verse, you know, perfect love drives out fear, and that does feel like a better dichotomy than anger. That's that all feels accurate. I think the part that I would want to like explore as we were having that conversation is twofold. One is the distinction between the scale, right? We're having these interesting moments where the scale of what we say to the culture at large on the internet and what we say to each other, right? And those, it's easy to conflate those, but actually, I think it's quite important to understand very different strategies for them. So for example, you know, I'm very heartened by, you know, the last part of what you said of how do we help each other, right? Because that, the answer is in the question. The answer is in the question in the sense that, when we are afraid on a local level, I'm going to speak locally, broadly, we'll get to internet, but, when we are afraid, what are we afraid of? What is this alternative that we are afraid of? You know, most of us don't have fears in which the alternative is death. You know, we're not sort of in a moment where it's like, well, I'm going to run up this hill and they're going to shoot and I'm going to, yeah, that is a meaningful and deep and important metaphor, which is like charging a hill. The alternative is death. And that's not actually, so that's such a large and abstract stake that, people tend not to be as bothered by that, right? It's the death of the ego. It's the death of the reputation. It's the fear of losing friends, the fear of losing access to livelihood, right? These are the actual, like, and we think of them as, I mean, I can say they're pettier fears than death and torture, but they're in fact deeply important. And to sort of wave them away is one, silly, but two, it's literally the stakes that we're all engaged in most of our time. We're not engaged with life or death struggles most of our time in our context. And that's good. But it should be given the gravity that it has. And I don't think we do that. I think it's very easy in communal settings when we have these conversations we do it to everyone else but ourselves to wave away those stakes. And I think every time I have been in a situation, let's say in a communal setting, a friend group, a church group, whatever, and these sorts of things come up, one of the first questions I am always trying to address is, let's be very clear here. I'm going to be your friend after this. These are not the stakes on the table. These are, because if trying to drive out fear, let's address what those fears are. Social opprobrium, you know, reputational damage. These are things that actually small towns, small communities, trade in. These are the currencies. And we don't often bring them to the table. And I think the reason the answer was in the question is, how do we help each other by helping each other, right? We actually have to have those in-person conversations in which we're constantly knitting the social fabric such that we are able to build these better ties so that those stakes don't feel as annihilating of our decision space. Right, to be able to help someone say, like, actually, there's a pretty large decision space here. I realize I'm telling this to a trained professional, so I'm hoping someone in here doesn't know this, but certainly it's not you. So you know, in this case, I think that's actually something that we miss a lot. We go to our corners really fast. I know I do. I like fighting. I was raised in like. We fight with like bloody teeth. We go in, we go hard. I was raised with very bad conflict resolution skills, is what I'm trying to say. And so, I go to my corner real fast and I'm actually looking to heighten your stakes, you know? And so that was something I had to figure out, late in life. On the larger scale, I think the strategies we're using to interact with each other on the larger scale, which is to say mediated through the internet, is like disastrous. It's like using a funhouse mirror to try to communicate visual information. It's completely built on distortion and completely open to hostile, antagonistic, and manipulative intervention. And so I think we have got to figure out how to use those platforms better. Social media, clearly, the algorithms of social media are not working if you're trying to build peace. And so we, I think, are forced, if we're going to continue engaging with the internet, we're going to have to figure out how to corral all the demons in there. And by that, I mean, like, quite literally, if you think Twitter is a good place to have a discussion, Friends, let me be the person to tell you, it's simply not the format, right? Like, if you wanted to have, like, I mean this literally, like, if I told you, like, hey, your beloved is dying, I was thinking that maybe you could have a can in this room, and I'll just have this little string, and we'll take it over there to this can. You'd be like, what are you talking about? I want to hold their hand right now. I want to look in their eyes right now. Get away from me. That is not the format in which I'm going to have this sacred conversation. That is what you would say, and you should. That's a silly thing for someone to do. And I think Twitter, to have a conversation where we convince each other of the most important things in our body politic, in these like little goofy, you know, punch buttons, is I honestly think we deserve the calumny if that's where we went to go have the conversation. We went to the Colosseum and went, gosh, what if I garden in the corner? Maybe my daisies will come up real pretty here. It's like, no, they're gonna get trampled by elephants. What are you talking about? This is the Colosseum. That's what it's for. Why were we gardening in the corner? So silly, terrible metaphor that just popped in my head. But the point is, I think we have to figure that out. It's not going to work. There are places, I think there's hope. Don't get me wrong. I think like broadcasting long form conversation is just infinitely better. So I think beginning there. All right, I'll stop screaming about, don't get me started on smartphones. That would be terrible. all right. Do we have time for one more?
Yeah, we have time for one more.
Okay.
So, only if it's Jacob though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jacob, how's things?
It's going to be a good one. Can you talk a little bit about how your time at Redeemer and sitting under Tim Keller's kind of teaching has impacted your writing life, but also just your flourishing?
Yeah. I mean, I crib his stuff more than anybody else. It's the challenge of, Tim Keller was my pastor for, 20 years. I attended Redeemer in New York. And so that's from 18 to 38, which means that I don't know of a window of time where I was thinking seriously as an adult about topics of theology. Like, I went to youth group as a 16-year-old and I memorized the books of the Bible. You know, like, I definitely felt as if I had a pretty strong grasp as a 17-year-old. I'm not saying I was unaware. But if you become my pastor at 18 to 38, I think it's simply fair to say that the Venn diagram of my understanding of theology is a very small circle within the large circle of Tim Keller's teachings, right? So like I think that's fair. I do disagree with him on some things. So it's like an M&M that's like slightly outside of a kiddie pool, you know, and you're like, okay. But it's, but fundamentally that's, I think it's like the fairest credit to give. Also, like, quite literally my first novella I ever wrote was like a farm allegory that was based on a sermon he gave, right? Like my understanding about like an absent God or the feeling of one anyway. And so he was someone who came into my life exactly when I needed it. He was somebody who sort of was thinking about theology with a particular bent toward, you know, he was actually sort of really bent toward the arts in a way that was very meaningful to a young artist, right? That I was like, oh, these things are meaningful. They're useful to pastors. Sometimes I think pastors will kind of pick their categories to, you know, for their opening chatty chat, you know, they'll be like, I was making nachos for the hockey game or something, or they'll sort of mention this kind of, you know, common format of the sermon friendly parts. And sometimes it'll just be like Pixar movies over and over again. And I'm not trying to dog on that, but I am trying to say, I sure am actually. I was just trying not to hurt anybody's feelings. But I think what one of the things that really, early on as a young artist, I started to perceive that maybe the arts actually do have a place in like the conversations of the eternal. And it's very easy to not think that. Again, coming up in the 90s, you know, there was a very strong hostility toward the arts when you were coming from maybe a more traditional church background. And so I not only did he sort of begin by winning me over in that way, but, you know, he wasn't just what's the right word? Pandering to my biases, right? He there was also, you know, he was somebody who over those years, what's the right word? you know, stretched a lot of my understanding of the word. And you know, I miss him quite a bit on that front. I wish we could still be hearing his sermons, but I get to listen to them, you know, on recording, and I'm really thankful that those exist. I suppose sometimes in cases like this, you know, there's an old adage that the easiest thing to write in the world is a bad review, and the hardest thing to write is a good review. With Keller, I have a pretty good review, so it's a hard thing to write because you just go, thanks. Is the only real comment I have on sort of a lot of his work. As I said, you know, I'm an adult, and I obviously, you know, I don't revere him into thinking of some kind of like saintly perfection. I think just like anyone else, he had ways he, you know, I disagree with. But why would I speak against the family? You know, like that's like, I think it's one of those things where, in an age where, again, bad reviews are disseminated very quickly and good reviews are too boring to recount, you have to be careful with all your bad reviews, right? And so in this case, I have just nothing but gratitude for somebody who very clearly, like, if you read my work and you're familiar with Tim Keller's, you'll be like, yeah, this kid was sitting in the back row. So my hope is just, yeah, I was very pleased when, you know, when I heard, you know, he had had the opportunity to read my stuff, and I was really through the grapevine. I hadn't really, all I can really say is how thankful I am that I was there in that window of time. Yeah. Cool.
That was a good last question. Thank you, Jacob. Hey, thank you, Dan. Oh,
I'm sorry. That's like a colloquialism we have in the West, right? So, yeah. So vado just sort of means law, or yeah. No, not as far as I know of, which is good. But yeah.
All right. Thanks, Arnie. Thanks, Daniel. Daniel gave us much to chew on tonight. We really appreciate all your insights and taking the time to just grace us with that beautiful lecture. Daniel is willing to sign books, correct? Yes. Okay. So we'll do that signing at the back where Prairie Lights is selling books. I want to thank Prairie Lights for coming out here tonight and helping out sell books. Also, a big thank you to Ty Coleman and City Channel 4 for recording tonight. So if you liked what you heard, you can go back and watch it on the channel. And then thanks to Jacob, our artist in residence, for also taking pictures and video tonight. So just to end our time here and to leave you with this, something that Daniel has already said, I assume, Daniel, as much as you don't like reading your own books, you don't like rereading your own lectures, right? But Daniel did say this tonight. He said, "The people who show bravery are those who have habituated their minds on something above themselves. It is the only way to truly live where the alternative is death." So let's take that with us tonight. Go in peace. Thank you for coming out.